Hello?
That was a cool thing about the 80s, you know, like, all those movies were like that.
One way or another, I'm gonna find you. I'm gonna get you one way or another.
Every one of my games, I try to do something brand new.
One way or another, I'm gonna see you.
Best time to get someone, man, when they're well fed and had a couple of wines. Welcome to the Retro Project Podcast. My name is Steve, and I am your host. Now, today on the show, we have a fantastic guest. We have a legend in the field of comic books. We are talking to Mr. J.M. DeMatteis. Now, J.M. is most well known for his runs on Spider-Man, Justice League, Captain America, Defenders. He also has his own works, which he's created, such as Moonshadow, which is just due out for a fantastic hardcover release, so keep an eye out for that if you're a fan of J.M. DeMatteis. You can also check him out at his website, which is www.jmdematteis.com. He also runs the Imagination Workshops, so go onto his website and check out details for that as well. J.M. will be joining us in just a little bit, but before then, I would like to let you know where you can find us. You can find us on Twitter at Retro Project Pod. You can also find us on Facebook at Retro Project Pod. And if you'd like to send us an email, we would love to hear from you. We are theretroprojectpod@gmail.com. You can also find all of our older episodes on iTunes as well. Just search for The Retro Project. And if you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It really, really does help the show. One last thing before we get into the episode, I would like to point out that the audio is not up to our usual standards, and I do apologise for that. We used a new platform called Zencastr, and it actually corrupted JM's side of the audio when the MP3 file was sent through to us. So I do apologise. It's still a great episode, and without any further ado, please welcome to the show Mr. J.M. DeMatteis. Let's start at the beginning.
I was born in a log cabin.
So you would be very, very good friends with Grizzly Adams and Gentle Ben.
Right, and Abraham Lincoln lived next door. It was a very nice neighborhood.
Surely it wasn't that long ago. It wasn't. We're not talking Civil War period, surely.
All right, let's stop this silliness.
Well, I asked someone, we'll start at the beginning, and their response was, well, there was a big bang. So we started a little bit earlier with you, which means there's not so much space.
Has anyone ever had, like, in utero memories, you know, or anything like that?
Not yet.
You know, Ray Bradbury claimed that he remembers being born. That he had clear memories of
really?
Being born and being, yeah. You read through his essays and things, and he talks about that.
That must be traumatic.
Or delightful, depending, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you don't know because you're not Ray Bradbury. Does he remember before he was?
I think he remembers. I think it was the being born and then being like just born and being like a totally newborn baby in a crib and all of that. Oh, I'd have to go back and look at his writing and see exactly, but it was he wrote about that a number of times.
Let's go the Ray Bradbury way of talking then. Do you have a first memory?
I do. I remember being very young. I know because of when we moved. At a certain point when I was about four. So I know that all the memories before that are like birth to four. And I do have memories of being in a crib. That much I know I do. And weirdly, or not weirdly, considering we are creatures of pop culture, one of my earliest memories is just is watching television. I must have been like three, two, sitting on the couch with my parents on either side of me watching television sometime in the 1950s. And I even remember the TV show, and I went and looked it up at one point. I was right in my memory. It was an old, well, it wasn't old at the time. It was an old episode of the Danny Thomas Show, which you probably don't even know what that is. But it was a very popular show in the 50s and 60s. So I remember that, and I remember, you know, you remember things like toys that you had, or I remember before going to school, and again, in this particular apartment, so I know I was younger than four, and what life felt like at age three or four. My father would be at work, my mother would be home, and from my little kid perspective, we had this kitchen that was like the size of a football field. It was probably a little room, but to a little three-year-old brain, it was huge. And I just remember my mother all the way across the football field, you know, doing what she was doing, and I would be in some corner somewhere just playing, you know? And you know, specific toys. I still have, I had these cowboy toys, They were, I guess they would be called action figures now, but they were like Roy Rogers and Wyatt Earp and things like that. With really cool hand-painted horses and figures, and I used to play with them endlessly. And so those are the kind of memories that I have of being young. So the main thing is, I guess, even then, the act of living in imagination, which a child does so easily and so effortlessly, and which, thank God, I managed to turn into a career.
It's amazing that what you talk about is the spatial awareness that you had as a child. Like, do you actually know this kitchen that you're talking about? Have you seen photos of it through the years? You know, actually,
I have some old photos of it. Yeah.
If you were to stand in there today, would it be as big as you remember?
No, absolutely not. No. From a 3-4-year-old's perspective, like I said, it seemed like a football field. It was probably a standard sized kitchen, not a big kitchen, but there was a table to eat in and a sink, and it was a kitchen. But for me, it was gigantic, and it really felt like I had this whole section of the football field to play in, and my mother was all the way on the other side, you know, at the sink, washing dishes or doing whatever she was doing.
So she was like the offensive line and you were the defensive.
Right. But the real memory is rooted in just that act of play, you know?
Yeah.
Just to be so deep into imagination and that you could, you know, project out through your imagination a whole world around you and play in it. It's pretty cool to be that in that world at that age.
And you could create a world based on what it was that you had around you.
Yeah, and that's all you need, a few toys, but you know, the imagination is what activated everything.
Where was this kitchen? What area was it? Where did you grow up?
Well, I was in Brooklyn. I grew up in Brooklyn, and where we lived till I was 4 was an area called Williamsburg, which these days is like super hipsterville, but then it wasn't. It was Williamsburg sort of bordered on Bedford-Stuyvesant. My father was Italian. He came from Bedford-Stuyvesant, which was all Italian. My mother was in Williamsburg, which was primarily Jewish. She was Jewish.
So if you're growing up and you've got a Italian and Jewish, is that a particular flavor to grow up with?
It's a fattening flavor. Because they both like to really feed you, you know? They really like to feed you, or in my case, overfeed you.
You're growing up with cowboy figures. You're growing up in the kitchen. You've got an appreciation for food.
Right, exactly. And there's a lot of, you know, between the Jews and the Italians, there's just so much guilt gets embedded, you know? They're both. The Catholics and the Jews are masterful at that, you know.
Man, I'm Irish Catholic, so I understand what it means, and I had a very heavily Irish Catholic grandmother. So, and I learned as I grew up, it wasn't God I was scared of; it was my grandmother.
Right. Well, from your perspective as a kid, she was probably God.
Yeah, you know what? She did rule. She ruled the family for sure. So is there a particular side that you think that as you grew up you kind of leaned towards, the Italian side or the Jewish side, or did you kind of mix and match and kind of take a bit from?
I think I mixed and matched, you know. I mean, I was technically, from a religious standpoint, brought up Jewish, but we were, you know, surrounded. My father's family was like 100 times bigger than my mother's family. They had so many kids and grandkids, and my old Italian grandmother, my mother had like 2 sisters, and her parents were already dead before I was born, so I never even knew any grandparents on that side. Although my Italian grandmother, even though she'd been in the country 60 years, didn't speak English, so I didn't exactly, you know, she'd call up and start talking in Italian, and I just hand the phone to my father. So I think I embraced both in a lot of ways. I didn't realize until I just went to Italy for the first time in June. We went to Sicily for a convention, and then went from Sicily to Calabria, which is where my father's parents were from. And through the grace of a good friend of mine, we went to the actual little town that my grandparents came from and met a whole group of, as they say, their Dimetes people, and had an incredible time. And I had such an amazing time in Italy that I realized, oh my God, I'm far more Italian than I realized, you know? So that part is very strong in me. And so even though I was technically raised Jewish, you know, we had Easter, Christmas was the big event. You know, we would go, you know, to my father's side of the family and go have these giant pasta dinners on Sundays. And so I really had both. You know, you got to eat all that Jewish food and Italian food. So, and you just got bigger and bigger. I think the Jewish side was, maybe it's more cultural, because I know a lot of Jews that I knew growing up weren't very religious, although my mother came from a religious home. She was not religious in my home. And it's more cultural. You know, when I look at this sort of pop culturally, the tradition of whether it's the people that in Hollywood or famous comedians or the people that founded the comic book business, all this sort of Jewish culture that's infused our pop culture, I have an identification there as well. So, yeah. So growing up, though, I was neither in a lot of ways. My Catholic friends looked at me as Jewish. My Jewish friends looked at me as this Italian kid. So on that level, it never quite fit, you know. But what it did for me was, yeah, I kind of growing up looked at them both and went, okay, this is all the same stuff to me. I don't see this huge difference. And because really no one was that religious in my family. You know, God wasn't something that came up a lot. My father would go to church every once in a while. Sometimes he would take me with me, and Catholic churches used to scare the hell out of me. We had this giant Catholic church across the street. I've never had this conversation on a podcast before. this giant Catholic church across the street. And, you know, you'd walk in and it's big and it's stained glass and all the images of poor Jesus suffering, you know, and it's dark. And my father would go to the little alcove and light candles, which was both magical and spooky. So Catholicism always had this sort of heaviness to it, you know. And then the Jewish side, the Jewish religion, like I said, the culture I connected and identified with, the religion, even though like they made me go and learn Hebrew and have a bar mitzvah, once I was done with that, I was done, you know, because it just didn't have any resonance.
How did your mother and father like reconcile it? Like, did you have brothers and sisters, or was it just your...
Yeah, I have an older sister.
So with you two, did you two just kind of get the opportunity to just fall in the middle, or was there ever a bit of a tug of war either way? Or?
Well, you know, I think there probably was a tug of war before we were born, because technically, you know, we were raised Jewish, which is why I had to go and have a bar mitzvah, which my sister didn't ever have a bat mitzvah or anything, but for some reason they wanted me to have a bar mitzvah. And my father, I have to say, enjoyed all the Jewish stuff, you know, he and my mother loved her Italian mother-in-law. So there was that flow and give and take. But there's a story, I talk about this in Brooklyn Dreams, my graphic novel. So my father wanted to name me John after his, I think it was his Uncle John. And my mother was like, John, that's too Catholic sounding. You can't do that, you know? So she wanted to name me Mark, with a C. And so what happened was, my father got to the birth certificate people first. And so my birth certificate was John Mark Imitates, right? And my mother heard that and freaked out. And honest to God, till I was in the sixth grade, she told me my name was not John Mark, it was Mark John. And she even spelled it J-O-N. So I have a birth certificate from the hospital, which is not the official one, that says Mark John, whereas my official birth certificate says John Mark.
You know, that is exactly what happened with my mother. My grandfather wanted to name her Carol Gloria. My grandmother, who I've mentioned before, she was absolutely batshit crazy. But I probably spent more time with her than anyone else in my family. I absolutely adored her. But she wanted the other way around. My grandfather wasn't around. She went and did the birth certificate. And as long as I think my mother was 14 years old when she saw the birth certificate, she'd been raised as Gloria. But her birth certificate says Carol.
So listen to this. Again, everyone go out and buy a copy of Brooklyn Dreams. You can hear these stories told much better. I'm in the sixth grade, and my father popped some sort of cork in his brain and shows up at school one day and pulls me out of class and takes me to the office and announces to me that my name isn't Mark John. It's John Mark, and he's changing all my records. Right? So this is how I find out. You know, it's like, what? I'm who? What? You know, it's very confusing, you know. And then, like, so it would be for years after that, I'd be in school and they'd call and say, John DeMatteis, and I'd go, call me Mark. And they'd all look at me like I was crazy, like Mark is some kind of weird nickname for John, you know. And so I wrestled with that for years. So it's, you know, am I Mark? Am I John? Am I J Mark? Am I John Mark? And finally, you know, I settled on JM because I thought that was the, just go with the initials and we'll all be happy. you know.
And then everyone else can just go with the flow. It's a pretty bold statement, though, to actually pull you out and have you there as he's doing the paperwork and all of the official thing and have you there to see it. That was a very bold statement.
Without getting too far into it, I'm sure my father and your grandmother had some crazy in common. And again, I hate to keep plugging Brooklyn Dreams, but if you go and read that, there's lots of stories in there where that becomes very evident. A very big-hearted, loving man, but also sometimes crazy as a loon.
The world does function a little bit better with a little bit of crazy. You know, mm-hmm. let's not go Trump level,
right?
You know, we don't need to go that far. And this isn't a political podcast, right. But I think I don't know your political affiliations or anything like that. But my assumption is, from the times I've spoken to you and from what I've seen about you, you're a reasonable man, and I don't imagine that you're a huge Trump supporter.
No, you are correct in that assumption.
Yeah, I could just that was an assumption I was happy to make.
Not a bold assumption in the least, yeah.
But a little bit of crazy is almost like just adding a little bit of salt and pepper to a lovely meal.
Well, you know, when you're a kid and you're surrounded by crazy, and you know, again, without getting too far into it, you know, but when you're a kid surrounded by that, you don't think of it as crazy. It's just what it is. You know what I mean? It's just reality, and it's only when you have time to step away and look at it with some objectivity that you realize, this is not normal behavior, you know, but you don't realize that till much later. It's just the soup that you're cooking in through your childhood, for good or for ill.
I didn't just grow up with a crazy grandmother. I'm the youngest, and I've got four older sisters. For me, it was, you know, the soup that you're talking about. There's a lot of ingredients in that childhood soup.
Well, you know, it is what makes us who we are, whether it's whether we become that thing we came from or whether we find our identity in separating ourselves out from what we came from, you know. Sometimes that very struggle to break away from that and sort through the crazy and everything else is what makes us who we are. And then hopefully you take what was good so there's always good even in the heart of the crazy. You know, like I said, my father had a lot of issues, but he had a very big loving heart as well. And so you take that part, and after some therapy, you leave the rest, you know.
Now, one of the things which I want to touch on is you're very, very well known for being a writer. That's one of the original reasons that we've spoken before in the past. And what I'll do is I will put a link to past conversations that we've had, because that's not what we're talking about today. You're a prolific writer, and I've made no secret whatsoever with my admiration for the things which you've written in the past, and people can hear me geek out about you in those two previous conversations. But a big part of your life, and one of the things which I went out of my way to do before we spoke today, was is I actually went and listened to some of your music, and I got to admit, I really liked it.
Great, thank you.
I probably shouldn't have used the word "I admit" at the beginning of that, but what I'm doing
I understand it would be, you never know with something like that when you know someone as one thing, and for all you know, it could have been the most horrible music in the world. You didn't know.
I've actually got a few of the tracks are on rotation in my car, along with Journey, Stan Bush, those kind of guys. But what I wanted to know is, do you remember the first album? Not so much the first album that you bought, if you can remember that, fantastic. Do you remember the first album that had a really prolific influence on you growing up?
Oh, probably the same thing as the first album I bought. I mean, I always loved music. Oh, I remember music around just all the time, and my mother must have had the radio on a lot. And I, you know, as a kid, just, you know, you sing because you're a kid and you like to sing, and I always enjoyed singing. But I was in the fifth grade when the Beatles came to America. And that's what rocked my world. And the first album I remember being like, my album, was Meet the Beatles, which was the American version of a British album that was called With the Beatles.
Was that the one with the four silhouetted faces?
Yeah. But, you know, Capitol in the United States took all the British albums, and like all their albums had 14 tracks. They'd put them out here with 10 tracks. They'd stick in a couple of singles. They'd leave some songs off so they could squeeze another album out of it. You know what I mean? So what we got in the United States, for a number of years, were not the actual albums as the Beatles made them. But with the Beatles, that was the big one. That was in, I guess, 1964. And that's what made me...
You still remember the year.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know because that's the year the Beatles came to America, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We all saw them on the Ed Sullivan Show and our jaws dropped. And I went, I want to be that, you know? I want to be John Lennon.
A Jewish Italian kid decided he wanted to be a Beatle.
I wanted to be John Lennon. Yeah, not very specific. Yeah. You know, it's true. I remember being in the fifth grade. You know, when all this Beatles stuff was happening, I had a dream, and I was still my little tubby fifth grade self. But somehow, within the dream logic, I was also one of the Beatles. And I remember in the dream, I'm like at school, and I said, wouldn't they all be surprised if they knew I was one of the Beatles? I've never forgotten that dream. I guess I'm still living it in some way.
If you're going to be a Beatle, though, be a Beatle where everyone knows who you are.
Right,
and then
exactly.
Everyone's turning around and going, it's James a Beatle.
I was like this
you know?
Beatle.
I'm sure they've made a lot of secret Beatles over the years, man. Right.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that there are millions of them out there, you know. But that's what made me want to pick up the guitar and kind of started my playing in rock and roll bands and writing songs and all that. It really all came out of that. That's what took just sort of a natural inclination toward musical things and made it a passion.
Yeah. Now, can I ask you, this isn't something I was planning on touching on, but now I was only 6 years old when it happened. Can I ask you, do you remember when John Lennon was shot?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
When I grew up, it was like I knew who the Beatles were, and then I found out after the fact.
Right.
It's a Kennedy-level kind of thing.
But yes, and for certainly from my generation, it was totally the Kennedy-level thing. I mean, the Kennedy's assassination is one of those memories of my childhood that's just burned into my brain, you know? And Lennon's murder was just – it was devastating.
No, it's not often that people have used that word either. Because a lot of people say assassination of John Lennon, but you just used the word murder.
Yeah, I guess I did. Well, I guess it's both. I mean, I guess because when you think of a public figure that's taken out in that way, in a very conscious way, that he did. He acted not like – wasn't a murderer. It wasn't this quick thing where someone broke in and shot somebody. This was a – he worked this out and he was going to do it. So he was an assassin and it was an assassination. But it's also a murder, and murder actually gets closer to the reality, doesn't it? You know, it's murder.
It's a more personal.
Yes.
But just with the fact that you said murder, it just took me to the point where I kind of thought, well, you took this personally. It was almost like he wasn't assassinated, he wasn't shot, he wasn't taken out. This guy was murdered.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and the funny thing is, like I said, because from the time I was in the fifth grade, I loved the Beatles, and out of all of them, the one I identified with instantly was Lennon. And years later, as I learned about his life and I kind of compared it to things in my life, I understood why my little psyche was drawn to him, you know, more than any of the others. And I was lucky enough, they're long stories, so I can't get into them now, to meet him on two occasions. I've written about it on my website, so you could dig around there.
And they are brilliant stories.
Oh, thank you.
You were kind enough to actually tell us these stories on the previous podcast.
Oh, we did. Okay.
And they were just
brilliant
stories.
And you know, and it's one of those, both those events are like, I look back and I go, did that really happen? And then I think it did, you know, and then I wrote it up and I shared it with a friend who was with me and he went, that's exactly what happened. So it's still, you kind of look back like it's a dream that I got to do this and meet him on those two occasions.
Well, what I might do, if you don't mind, what I might do is I might cut those stories out of the previous podcast and I might just add them to the end of this, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure. Feel free. Yeah. And so it was a very personal connection I was home that night, and I got a phone call from actually Karen Berger. Karen Berger, who's, you know, the creator of the Vertigo imprint at DC, and who now has Berger Books over at Dark Horse. And we were very good friends. We were friends before either one of us worked in comics, you know. And she was the one who called me out to tell me that, and I burned into my brain as well. She, you know, said John Lennon was shot, and I said, "Is he okay?" She said, "He's dead." And it's one of those moments of just like kind of this thunderous silence that rolls across the universe. But what I remember so distinctly is my first reaction wasn't like, oh, some celebrity is dead. I felt like a friend of mine had been killed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was very deeply personal. And then it was almost a shock at first when you realize the whole world took this very personally. You know what I mean? Because his music was so intensely, it really came from the deeps of his soul, especially his solo music, which I adore. It wasn't like just pop songs about, you know, falling in love. It was about his heart and his soul and his childhood and everything he was going through. It was easy to have that kind of personal connection. And then suddenly you realize, first you think, oh, my friend John Lennon is dead, you know. Then you realize everybody's friend John Lennon is dead. But I still, you know, I'm still obsessed with the Beatles, and I spend way too much time on YouTube looking at old Beatles videos. And there's some, you know, we live in this information age where, oh my God, everything you could ever want is out there. Every interview that you could ever want to see, every clip of the Beatles in concert, all these bootlegs, all these things are just at your fingertips. So I absolutely spent too much time looking at that stuff.
And that is the end of the first part of our chat with J.M. DeMatteis. Now, as promised, after this little part, we will be putting in the stories that J.M. told us previously about meeting John Lennon, so stick around for that. Now, until then, I'd just like to let you know where you can find us. You can find us on Twitter at Retro Project Pod. You can find us on Facebook at Retro Project Pod. And you can also send us an email if you'd like to drop us a line at theretroprojectpod@gmail.com. You can also find all our old episodes on iTunes, so go back, have a listen to some of the guests that we've spoken to already, and if you like the show, please leave us a review. It really, really does help us out. So until next time, thanks for listening, and this has been the Retro Project Podcast.
Now, you actually got the opportunity to meet John Lennon, didn't you?
I did, yeah. On a couple of occasions, you know? If someone wants to look, go to my website. If you could have to scroll through, and you'll find I wrote this in great length of the stories of both encounters. But I had a good friend from my musician days who was a musician who was managed by a guy named Roy Sakala, who ran a very big recording studio in New York called The Record Plant, which is where Lennon recorded. And so there were two occasions where we used to go hang out at The Record Plant because I was a teenager. I was like 19. It was a cool place to hang out. And we were hanging out one night, and in troop John Lennon, and picked up a guitar and started jamming with my friend's band, and I'm sitting 3 feet away watching this with my jaw on the floor, you know. That's the short version of the first one. And the second time was they invited me because he was using my friend's band as his backup band. They were filming some videos. He had done the Rock and Roll album, and they were filming some videos for a TV show in England. And I got to sit there in the studio in a nice, comfortable seat in the booth and watch them all day as they filmed these videos. It was incredible, incredible. You know, awestruck, and could hardly speak a word.
I can imagine. Yeah. You know,
so if you ever see the video of John Lennon singing "Stand By Me," I was sitting there a few feet away watching them.